actually to tetrahedra. And so you, for you not to be confused, here we understand the tetrahedron. No, it's a, you would say it's a 3D object, and we do canonical quantum gravity. And 2 plus 1, so it should be two-dimensional, but actually we consider the surface of this tetrahedra, which is a perfect 2D manifold, or at least piecewise linear manifold. Okay, and so the first thing you have to, so the flatness constraints where that f is equal to 0, and so the f, again, if you write it as a function of the connection, was a mildly complicated function. I write it, you know, something like that, if you write it in this Lie algebra valued form language. I think this is correct. Yeah. and so it's, again, difficult to quantize, and indeed we don't really have the connection, but we only have holonomies. So the first thing you would have to think about is what does replace, how do you quantize f? And the answer is basically Wilson loops. And so you might have seen that for instance, electromagnetism, if you take the holonomy, actually, if you ever discussed what is called the Aharonov-Bohm effect, then you might have encountered this discussion. Take, say, at least for a abelian case, which would be electromagnetism, take the holonomy, which we defined as exponential minus gamma A. So you are abelian, you don't really need path ordering. then, you know, so now you just deal with forms. So they're not Lie algebra valued, so you know all the standard theorems. And I hope you have heard of Stokes' theorem. And that's what we are going to apply here. And this is that you can transfer these. So if you have a form, and so this form is an n minus 1 form, and you take d of this form, then you get an n form. And so you can integrate it over a manifold, which is n dimensional. And then transferring d's means you can transfer this d to actually the boundary of your manifold. And you integrate the form itself, which is now n minus 1, an n minus 1 form over the boundary of the thing. And so this means here, so here we apply it in the inverse way. So we go from here to here, and as gamma is a surface which is bounded by the curve gamma, and another fact of the theorem is then that it does not matter how you choose the surface. So it can be any surface, and indeed, you know, the original thing was just defined via the curve and didn't know about the surface. And so in the abelian case, you indeed get this as the exponential of f. Modulo some minus signs. I think there should be minus sign here. It's a bit unclear. And this, you know, you can always write to order kind of epsilon squared as one minus the thing, and so this holonomy approximates the average of your curvature over the surface. And this holds for the Dirac case. And now, actually, a similar theorem holds for the non-Abelian case. But you might really question how that works, because you actually have here a term which is R wedge A. And so how does this term appear in this discussion? Because here you basically just use a Stokes theorem. And so you see that that you get this term, but not how we get this term. So we will discuss this now. And actually now go to the non-Abelian case. And so I will only derive it to a certain order in the length of your curve. But actually this non-Abelian Stokes theorem, so this is already kind of high mathematics, holds actually exactly. And one can find it in the literature. So gamma S is a closed curve, and it should have length, coordinate length, epsilon. And so we will consider terms up to epsilon squared. And so H gamma, if I expand it, and I expand now the path ordered exponential, and so for one, for the first term, I don't really have any path ordering. And so for the second term, this is a path ordering. And then you have higher order terms in epsilon. And so this term we just discussed, basically, here you apply to each component of A, you apply Stokes' theorem. So that's just indeed the dA term which you need here. And so this is an or, this is an integral over a surface, and gamma was at length epsilon, so the integral over the surface is of order O epsilon squared, and we take terms up to O, up to epsilon squared, actually. Okay, and so now we have the second order terms called S. And so we need to deal with these. And to do that, we will write them as a this term, we will split it into a symmetric part and an antisymmetric part. And so the so we commute these two terms. And then here's the anti-symmetric part, which is the same like this minus this term. And so we have this anti-symmetric part. And for this, so the argument now goes that you can actually neglect this, this symmetric part. For the following reason that you now it's symmetric, and so you don't need to care about the ordering of these things. So you could just take the integral over separately. I mean, take the integral over S2 here and S1 there, and get basically the square of this previous integral. And so we have seen that this previous integral was of order epsilon squared. So you conclude that this integral would be of order epsilon to the power of 4. So this is met. And that's the reason why we can neglect it. So this would be of order epsilon to the 4. And so you need to just care about this antisymmetric part. And here you do this kind of standard approximation argument. So you have here these integrals, and you do kind of a midpoint approximation. Actually, in this case, it would be an initial point approximation. So you write this as approximately some point in the interval which you integrate over, and take this integrand here, and just integrate over the constant. You know, it's a constant, which is a constant function, and that gives you basically the volume. In this case, yeah, the volume of the region you integrate over. So if you do that, you actually just get this result. So we take the integrand to be at the point zero. So therefore, it's not really a midpoint. And then from the commutator, you get actually the following. So all these, if I remind you, all this very abstract notation without any indices means that you integrate a form. And to integrate a form, you take this form index and contract it with the tangent vector to the curve. And so this is the tangent vector to the curve. So this one can tangent vector. Second one. And because you had the commutator there, or antisymmetric thing, you have an antisymmetric combination of these. And then so this is an approximation which gives you the second order, and so you have also, of course, higher order terms. And so you have this constant term in front, and now you just need to worry about the term, this term. And actually, if you you can guess, because you have some anti-symmetric combination here, you know, if you would be in kind of Cartesian coordinate this would be dxa dxb minus dxa dxb. And so indeed, what you get is, working out the detail, you integrate over S gamma and you get the wedge product between these differential forms. So actually what happened is that you pulled this in front of that, and here you get basically the integral over just the surface, the area, the integral over the surface, which gives you the area. And so now you approximate backwards. So now you put these values in there again, and you conclude that this is all these minus signs, 1/2 and whatever. This is A wedge A. Plus higher order terms, minimistics here. And putting all these terms together, so we had H gamma, it was given by minus 1, then we had S gamma, and we had dA, and here we have a plus. E which A, so why should we have a plus? So this is a minus 1 which comes here. And so this is indeed 1 minus S gamma curvature. And so the answer where this term A which A comes from is from the path ordering and this antisymmetric combination. And so this is basically non-Abelian Stokes theorem, at least to this order epsilon squared.
Where does a factor of 2 come from when you went from the tangent vectors to the volume?
Okay, so this is my, I think this comes from some conventions. So if you, I can give you this calculation. It slightly depends on your conventions for your differential forms, which for the wedge product, I think. And so here to get from this term to here, I do one integration. And so if you really use the embedding, this means along the curve, it's this is dxa, xb, minus xa, dxb. And so now you take the differential again by using Stokes' theorem. And so depending on all kinds of conventions for the exterior derivative and your wedge product, so this would be dxb wedge dxa, and then minus dxa wedge dxb. So you commute it again, and you get at least 2 terms. And so you get here actually minus 2 dxa dxb. Yeah, because you use this film. And yeah, so here you get minus dxa. So here the convention is that the differential form, the differential of kind of a one form of this form is just d veg. The differential of this function veg this dxb, dxa. Let's write a df dx df veg. Okay. But one needs to be slightly careful because there's I think at least two conventions regarding this differential forms which differ by one over n factorial terms. Okay, so this is non-Abelian Stokes theorem, and this tells us that we can actually approximate our holonomy, our curvature, with the holonomy. And so this is actually what we are going to use as our constraint. So we have f equal to 0. And so instead, we will use the holonomy around any curve. Should not be 0, but since we have 1 minus f, it should be equal to 1. And so you can write a constraint associated to gamma, and you can already quantize that. Or you can write the delta function, actually the delta function associated to this constraint C gamma. And so you define C gamma to be H gamma minus 1. And this would be actually the delta function the delta function taken of the holonomy of a closed curve gamma. Okay, and that's what we are going to use. And so we go to this tetrahedron and look. And consider all possible curves. And so again, what one does actually if one has this tetrahedron, so now it's actually a dual tetrahedron. So if I write it in this funny form of looking on top of that, I get this graph which I squashed into 2D. And so there's a question, how many curves can I find which are useful? And of course, you could take all kinds of small curves here. But it's actually sufficient to take curves which, you know, along the spin network edges, which are already there. In this case, in 3D, actually. And so we can take this loop. And so this is actually, so this area is called a face. And we can take this loop this is oriented this way. And we can this take this loop. And of course, you could now ask, I can also take a loop which goes along like these two faces. However, if you impose that this loop is trivial and this loop is trivial, you actually get automatically that a loop around two faces is trivial. Because it would be just, you go here, and then you say you go along this curve, you see that that this gives you a curve, then you go here, then you say you go here, and so this actually is a combination of these two curves, but you can, since you just went in this direction and then you went in the opposite direction, this term actually disappears because it's the g, g minus 1, which gives you 1, and you get this yellow remaining curve over two faces. But you don't need to impose it because it's already imposed by the other constraint. And so in fact, now going to this tetrahedron, you already see a nice theorem, which is actually the or a nice identity is an integral form of the Bianchi identity. Because so far I've drawn you three loops, but you see that this tetrahedral graph has actually four faces. And in this picture, I told you yesterday that abstractly you define this face to be the outside of this tetrahedron, of this graph, so-called planar graph. So everything outside is a fourth face. So if you want to go around this fourth face, you would have a curve which goes along this way. And so you would put it here. So these would be just all these curves in this picture. And here it's a bit hard to draw. And then you would have also a curve going on this lower triangle. And so these would be the four loops. And here this lower triangle is represented by this loop. However, you again see Bianchi identity, like BF equal to 0 with respect to this E with respect to your spin connection. Now the same applies as previously. So you can actually get this fourth loop by a combination of these three loops. And so I can draw it, but then you won't see anything. Orange. that if you want to go along this curve, you go first this way, then you go this way. Let's see whether this works. Oops, I guess. Okay. So now you go this way. Cancel this thing. Go this way, this way, this way, you cancel this thing. Go this way, the other way. And so here again, these things cancel. This thing cancel. And so the only two edges which we didn't transversed one after the other are these two edges. But this is just a conjugation of your holonomy. And this doesn't matter if you impose that it's actually equal to 1, because 1 is the one element which is invariant on a conjugation. So if I write it to you in terms of formulas, We have this numbering of edges, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we have holonomies, H1, H2, H3, H4. And so H1 is this one. H2 is this one. H2 is this one. And H3 is this one. And H4 is the one outside. And then, you know, it happens. So you have two starting points, but it happens basically that I told you has this conjugation, T2, H1, H, and you have then a product of three holonomies. And H4 has given us a product of these three holonomies conjugated with T2. But if this is equal to 1, if all these are equal to 1, then this will be also equal to 1. And so this is actually an integral form of this Bianchi identity and has something to do with homology. And so there's a concept of the number of independent cycles in a given graph. And in this case, you have only three independent cycles. So this tells you what you want to impose. Is not the delta functions of for loops, because if you do this, so now we are in this dangerous situation that the constraints, the gauge orbits which are generated by these constraints, we have seen that these are translations, so they are non-compact, and this is the reason why this delta function is really a proper delta function, whereas for the Gauss constraint it was not such a problem. These were generated rotations which have compact orbits. And so we could just, you know, apply 10 of these delta functions as a Gauss constraint, because you would just integrate over compact orbits. Here we have infinite integrations, and if you apply too many delta functions, you will get an infinity. And so in this case, if you would apply the delta functions for all of these four loops, you would indeed get redundant delta functions. It would be like having a square of delta functions. And so that's why we actually only take three of these delta functions. So here you need to be more careful with avoiding redundancy in your constraints. And so this would be, like we can define it as delta function on the flatness constraints, on all of the flatness constraints. And it's a product of these three delta functions. And so just told you it's a problem. Flatness constraint generates non-compact orbits. And if you remember, I discussed with these two examples with having a constraint which is equal to the momentum on R. And there we had this problem that the delta function in P leads to a state which is not L2 R anymore. And we had to change our inner product to accommodate for that. So that's a possibility. And here we could do it explicitly, but there's an implicit form of doing this. So what does it mean that this state is not anymore integrable? It means that this kind of product, or this product gives you infinity in the kinematical inner product, which is not surprising because what you do is what you could do is because this P is a, I mean, you hope that this is in a projector, and so it's self-adjoint, so you hope that, or you hope that's kind of self-adjoint or symmetric, so you hope that you can actually bring that to the other side, and then you see you get a square of delta functions. And so you say, I have one delta function too many, and so actually it's sufficient if you have two states, and you are interested in the so-called physical inner product to impose the delta function only in one entry, because you could, you know, this is equal to psi prime delta pi psi, and kinematical. And indeed, this is what is defined to be the physical inner product. And so this is equivalent to dropping this integration over R for higher dimensions, for if you're actually in R4 or something, or R2 or something higher dimensional. So this is defined to be the so-called physical inner product. And indeed, you can see it from this form that it's equivalent of imposing kind of, or doing group averaging morally over both entries. Because here you get a constant state, and then you integrate it over something non-constant. But all these non-constant components of this state are orthogonal to this state. So they just drop out automatically. And so this is guaranteed by this, in case that this delta function P is actually symmetric. And so this is actually a definition called the physical inner product, which in this case is equivalent to dropping one integration over R from your kinematical inner product, and that was the procedure we discussed before. Okay, so that means what, you know, indeed what the argument is in general, what you can compute, what you're finally interested are these transition components between two states, in particular in gravity. And so it's made physical by inserting a constraint here. And since the constraints involve the dynamics, it's actually really a transition amplitude. It's really something dynamical, you know, because the constraint generate actually time evolution. And it says time. Okay, I don't think I explained it. It really, you can actually see it from deriving the path integral. But we didn't do that. So you can actually derive the path integral from imposing the constraints. And that would explain it. So if you have really delta C here, but I can actually explain, since you all look a bit puzzled. comes from this kind of argument that you say the delta function you can write as an exponential of I ct. And so we say that c, for instance, in the case of the parameterized particle, really does time evolution. And so in this case, you would actually do a time evolution of the state. And yeah, so this would be ut kind of a unitary evolution of this state. And this you can rewrite into path integral. But before this, you see that this is kind of, it's a weird integrated transition amplitude between psi prime and psi, where you time evolve that. And it looks a bit weird, but indeed you have to remember that inside here, you know, it's not only that you have, that these states depend on q, but they also depend on your time variable. So actually I should call maybe this a time parameter s, and this is s. So here I have f, so I'm doing something bad, but just for the sake of explanation, here these states depend on q and t. So this actually allows you to write something like this. You could actually write f this as psi of q times a function in t. And so you could take delta t minus t0, which would not be really integrable in the kinematic inner product, but it would completely localize the state at t0. And so indeed, if you do that here and then with t2 here, I think what you get in this formula is really the transition amplitude, the propagator, the standard propagator between t1, t or t0 and t0 prime here. And alternatively, what this tells you is really in this framework that you should maybe put a Gaussian here, and then you get a kind of smeared out initial value propagation here. And this would be integrable, psi of q. So this again, you know, this would basically define you a physical inner product. And so from this example, you might understand, or you might have a motivation to interpret this as transition amplitudes. But in fact, it's only transition amplitude if you put very specific states into here. Okay. And so this is all a bit with this problem, you know, the problem of how to interpret time. Which comes in, but so what we wanted to say is that, or to arrive at that, what we should consider is this physical inner product between two states, which is defined as here applying all kinds of constraints. To one entry and taking the kinematical inner product. So using this, we can basically define the physical inner product between two tetrahedral spin networks. Uh, So actually here, the psi prime, so if you use the spin network basis, these are labeled by, so these are functions still of the holonomy, but they are labeled by spins J and J prime. As we have discussed yesterday, you have one spin associated to every edge, and all the other magnetic indices are contracted with intertwiners, which are unique. So the state just depends or is labeled by these spin labels. And so you want to look into the inner product between this state and then applying the delta functions. And these three holonomies. And here, these are the tetrahedral states. And so now it's a bit painful to write this all out. So this would be the transition amplitude. And so these tetrahedral states, they depend on six edges. So you have a group integral over six, in six group, g to the six. And so yesterday, I wrote you these tetrahedral states, and they came with a coefficient, which was the sum over like four Clebsch-Gordons. So I don't really want to write the Clebsch-Gordons again. and so I make an abbreviation. It's here. So these are basically these combinations of three M symbols with entries J prime, Q prime, P prime. And so this is the same combination which we had at the end of yesterday's lecture. And then something happened with this was summed over actually the spin network basis, which means your normalized states. So for some reason, the normalizations don't appear here. Ah, okay, I put the normalizations into F, or if you want, if I just told you that these are all these states, so you have a product of all the dimension factors here. These things, and you have these other state. Okay, it's the same coefficients here. And okay, the same dimension factor here. K square root of dk. So it's the dimension of ji, and here it's dimension of jk of these two tetrahedra. This might have different spins, this is case, and then you have also. PK, these group elements. And now it's a bit complicated. Yeah. So here, these are with respect to. So now I have it's a bit computationally difficult. Actually, I should take here the same index, but it's prime. And these are primes. Or these were primes, so these, yeah. And this index E is basically the same index because you want to, you need here really the same group elements because you take the inner product. Okay, and now I have this lengthy formula. So here I need to write these holonomies. So these are the delta functions of the three holonomies. And I would need to integrate over all six group elements.
So about the delta functions for the holonomies, this, I guess, going back a little bit, how do we know that our loops are small enough that we can use that approximation?
So indeed, it's a subtle issue. And indeed, formally, you should make a limit of doing all these loops. And you will actually, in the end, get the same result. And it's, however, a bit, you know, would take more time, much more time to discuss this properly. So in this case, like we really fix that, we say we work in a discretization. And we fix a triangulation and a dual complex. And if you do that, you know that the curvature is only around the spaces. And so, you know, in a simplicial complex, it's a bit hard to draw now, but so this is now really the tetrahedron. In a simplicial complex, these will be always trivial holonomies if you have a loop inside now a triangle. Which is actually a loop like here. And so only curvature comes from having loops around the vertices. And so if you take the dual, the vertices are equal to the faces. And so that's what we assume for the sake of this discussion. But indeed, you need to, in principle, you would need to take a continuum limit. And get some result, which is actually related to this other vacuum, other than the Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, like the BF vacuum. But in practice, it's actually sufficient to consider these loops. Okay, so it's a good question, but it will take some time to go through it properly. You know, it's not as easy for us for the Gauss constraint. For the Gauss constraint, it shows that explicitly. Here you're right, we need to actually consider this Wilson loop everywhere. And this will completely change the vacuum, the Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, into this BF vacuum. However, the final result will be kind of the same as we will derive here. So now we have this integral. So let me just say this in the last minutes. And as I told you, you can actually go through it explicitly. I mean, I mentioned last lecture, you can go through it explicitly. So what you would do is you solve for these delta functions. That's obviously the easy part. So you solve for these delta functions, and you have to make a choice. And so solving for these delta functions, since you have three delta functions, will kill you three of your integrals, hopefully. I think it does. And then you have three integrals left. But you can actually rewrite. You see that if you do that explicitly, you see that these integrals turn out to be integrals over the gauge orbits of the Gauss constraints. And so they would just be, you know, you can rewrite that as right and left actions on the d's, because if you solve for g1 here, you have to put in here that g1 or g6 is equal to g2 times g1 minus 1. And so you do that, and then you would rewrite this Wigner matrix of a product of group functions as a, or you can just interpret this, for instance, as like the right action with g1 minus 1 on g2. And it turns out that it's always the case that these leftover integrals, so if you have g1 here, they would, you know, you can interpret these leftover integrals as a gauge action at the vertex. And however, you know that you have written a gauge invariant state, so you can actually gauge fix, and you gauge fix these three group elements equal to the identity. And that means that all your group elements will be basically evaluated at the identity. And this is not very surprising, because what we did here is that to say we impose flatness constraints, which means all these holonomies have to be the identity. And these holonomies give you all the information, all the gauge invariant information there is of this. In the connection. And so equivalently, you could just put all group elements equal to the identity. However, initially, you couldn't really write that as a bunch of delta functions, because then you would have gotten lots of redundant delta functions. So the result is that actually you can just evaluate this integral by putting all these d's equal to the identity. And so what happens if we put a d, g, and put this g in equal to the identity?
You get Kronecker deltas.
You get Kronecker deltas, indeed. So you get these Kronecker deltas in q prime and p prime, and q and p. And q prime and p prime are here. And so then this is the formula I mentioned yesterday. So these are the three JM symbols, the four three JM symbols. And so if you take the Kronecker delta and these parameters q prime and p prime, this is defined to be the six J symbol. So indeed, in fact, after doing this, if you buy this argument, you get just these leftover dimensional factors. You had this here and here, and then you get a product of these two 6J symbols. And so this is the transition amplitude. Actually, now you're happy because you completely solved 3V gravity, modulo all these questions about the continuum limit. And so it's, you know, so the final answer is that continuum limites for topological theories are typically trivial, because you're just interested in the topological information, which is global information, or it, the theory just carries topological information. And so we will try to interpret this result tomorrow. So this gives you basically the transition amplitudes between all kinds of states with different size tetrahedra. And so particular transition amplitude is actually if you start from the transition amplitudes where all these j's are zero. And as you can guess, the 6J symbols where all the J's are zero is kind of equal to one. And you go to some finite size tetrahedron. And modulo these interpretational difficulties, you can interpret this as the probability of a universe being born. But it's a bit dangerous to interpret this in this way, for in this case. Because it's also the probability of the universe being annihilated, actually, and to disappear. Okay, so that's, we will discuss a bit this interpretation of the result tomorrow, and depending, yeah, I might try to tell you about all these things which we haven't discussed and apply to 4D gravity.